About the sugarcane aphid.
Whitney?
Thank you, Dr. Musser. So the focus of this project was to look at the influence of sugarcane aphid on the potential implications of honeybees. So just a quick introduction on the sugarcane aphid. They were first reported in Hawaii in 1896. They then moved to the continental U.S. in 1994 in Florida and in 1999 on sugarcane. There was then some type of biotype shift or a host shift in 2013 where we then found them on on grain sorghum. You can see on the map in 2013 this one Maroon County was where sugarcane aphids were detected on grain sorghum in the state of Mississippi. Then moving into 2014, they were in the majority of the northern part of the state and a couple of the southern states of Mississippi. Then looking at across the southeast, looking in 2015, the green counties or the occurrence of sugarcane aphid on grain sorghum, it's become a widespread issue in many areas. So the far picture is sugarcane aphids occurring or colonizing on the leaf. The middle picture is the difference between effectively controlling sugarcane aphids and not. You can see on one side of the field, the grain sorghum has no heads. The sugarcane aphid wasn't controlled, so we're seeing 100% yield loss. Comparing that across the row where you can see the grain sorghum has heads, we're going to have a yield, and so there is a difference in effectively controlling sugarcane aphid and not. Just because you're in those later reproductive stages doesn't necessarily mean that you're out of the woods. Even moving later into that grain field, you still have the potential to see loss from the effects of sugarcane aphid. So once the sugarcane aphid was detected in the state of Mississippi, a number of studies were conducted to determine the effects of infestation on yield. So at various crop stages, we looked at 20% infestation with no treatment. What was the percent yield loss we were potentially going to see? So in that pre-boot stage where you have that flag leaf that you can see within the whorl and our heads beginning to develop, anywhere from 81 to 100% yield loss. Moving a little bit later at that boot stage where our leaf is fully expanded, anywhere from 52 to 69% yield loss. Then moving a little bit later into panicle emergence, it's still not quite as great, but still seeing about 67% yield loss, which is high. Then moving later into those reproductive stages and at that soft dough, even though it is later, we're still seeing 21% yield loss. So that's something to be mindful of. So as far as the use of individual seed treatments, you can see with clothianidin, imidacloprid, and thimethoxam, there was no difference from the untreated check in respect to yield, but comparing that to flupyridifuron in furrow at two different rates, we're seeing higher yield when we have sugarcane aphids present. So as far as the use of a seed treatment and in furrow application, on average, seeing about 50 days after planting of control. And then we see the rise in sugarcane aphids. So with this, hopefully we're able to minimize some of our foliar applications that may be needed later in the season, which is going to help minimize the risk to pollinators. So there's a number of factors that are potentially impacting pollinator health, whether it be due to pest, pathogens, management. Pesticide exposure is one of those that ranks among that list. In addition to pesticide exposure, how does crop attractiveness potentially play a role in pollinator health? So the USDA put out a report in 2015 on crop attractiveness of various crops. Grain sorghum under certain conditions is an attractive crop for honeybees as a source of pollen and nectar. Therefore, the objective of this study was to determine the frequency of foraging honeybees and grain sorghum and the potential implications from the use of insecticide seed treatments and in furrow applications. So talking a little bit about our bee scouting, this was conducted in 2016 in Starkville, Mississippi. We went out and scouted eight fields for 3 weeks, and there were apiaries present. We've scouted various stages of grain sorghum, late vegetative stages all the way through reproductive stages. We went out midday, so 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. with four observers that walked 50 meters of row for a total of 200 meters of row and recorded the number of honeybees and honeydew present. That data were analyzed with PROC-REG and PROC-MIX procedure of SAS 9.4. Then, as far as our pollen analysis is concerned, this was conducted again in 2016 in two different locations. In Starkville, Mississippi and Jackson, Tennessee, we implemented a randomized complete block design with four replications. The individual seed treatments and in-furrow applications that we evaluated were imidacloprid, thimethoxam, clothianidin, and then two rates of flupyridipuron, a lower rate of 58 grams of AI per hectare, and then a higher rate of 102 grams of AI per hectare. So as far as our pollen collection, we went out and shook 50 heads at 50% bloom. That pollen was then sent to the National Science Laboratory where they analyzed those samples for insecticide detections. That data was then analyzed with PropFreak and SAS 9.4. So moving into our specific results, I want to talk a little bit about our honeybee analysis before I move into what we saw in our pollen. So as far as looking at honeybees comparing blooming and non-blooming grain sorghum, we had the highest number of honeybees present when grain sorghum was in bloom. We also tried to determine if there was a relationship between honeydew and the number of foraging honeybees, and there is a positive relationship between those two factors. The level at which honeybees are potentially foraging can be impacted by the surrounding area. So for us, we had a mixed crop in environment. As we moved through our weeks of sampling, we did progress in the number of overall honeybees. Where we had the highest number of honeybees in week three, there was no statistical difference between the weeks. However, the later sampling could be due to the fact that their surrounding environment was senescing and potentially this was a better food source than some other options in the area. So then I want to move forward and talk a little bit about our pollen samples and the insecticide detections that our results. So as far as thimethoxam and imidacloprid, there was no detection in any of our samples for either one of those products. We did have one detection of clothianidin at 71.6 parts per billion. We did have a detection of clothianidin at 25.7 parts per billion and flupyridipuron at 3.9 parts per billion. In our untreated control, and this could be due to some type of contamination, whether it was at planting or during seed packaging. So talking about our flupyridipuron concentrations in furrow at the lower rate of 58 grams of AI per hectare, 29 of our samples, or 91% of our samples, had zero detection. We then had three samples, or a little over 9%, that had a 2.1, a 4.8, and a 5.1 detection, or parts per billion. And then looking at that higher weight of 102 grams, 23 samples or 85% had zero detection. Then we had four samples that we had a concentration of 5.4, 5.8, 8.4, and 8.9. So what does that necessarily mean as far as pollen consumption and impact on honeybees? So Campbell et al. Put out a study looking at the safety profile of flupyridipuron. And the EPA established that the chronic no observed effect level for that product is 0.79 micrograms of AI per bee. They also estimated that the maximum daily intake of pollen is 9.6 milligrams per day. So what does that mean as far as the highest level of concentration that we had in relation to the bee? So if you solve, essentially solve for X for pollen consumption and take that 8.9 is what we found, and to get that 0.79 micrograms of AI per bee, the bee has to consume roughly 3 ounces of per day to ever reach that no observed effect level. That's 9,000 times higher than that 9.6. Well, so then you think about it with our highest rate of clothianidin at 72 parts per billion, they're still having to consume over 1,000 times more than what they would normally consume on a daily basis, even just to reach that level. So what does that mean going forward? We know that our bee frequency is much higher. During our blooming grain sorghum periods, there is a relationship between honeydew and honeybees. And as far as the use of seed treatments in grain sorghum, they're an important management tool for sugarcane aphids. And hopefully, but through the use of seed treatments, we're able to minimize the number of foliar applications later in the season, minimizing the risk of any potential pollinators in the field. As far as the detections that we were seeing, they were very minimal, and So that's just something to be mindful of. And so moving forward, we know that at least in this study, what we were finding was on the safer side, and we know that seed treatments are an effective tool, and they're going to have to increase very high quantities of pollen. So with that, I would like to thank all of the graduate students and everyone that helped make this possible, in addition to the sorghum checkoff board. And with that, I have plenty of time for questions if you have any. So the question was, how are we measuring honeydew levels? We were just, when we were walking our 50 meters of row, we were counting the number of plants that had honeydew present in that span. Yes, ma'am. So the question was, why did we choose to sample between 10:30 and 1:30, and do we think it would change depending on if we sampled at a different time of the day? Waylon et al. Actually did a study looking at the different time frames to scout for honeybees, and in our area, looking at cotton, soybeans, and corn, they found the most midday, and so that's why we chose that specific time frame. Yes, sir. So we went off of the assumption that with the apiaries present, everything in the field was honeybees, is what we were looking for. Yes, sir. There was other bees. We were just focusing mainly on honeybees. Any other questions?
All right. Thank you, Whitney.
Thank you.